Welcome to the Bioethics Podcast, a project of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity at Trinity International University. I'm Matthew Epinette, Executive Director of the Center. This episode of the podcast features one of the plenary addresses from our 29th annual summer conference, Integrity and Conscience, Bioethics and the Professions, which we held just a couple of weeks ago. All the content from the conference, 8 plenary addresses, 4 sponsored workshops, and more than 20 paper presentations, all of these are now available on demand through the conferencing app. Email events at cbhd.org today for information on how you can access this conference content. That's events at cbhd.org. This episode features one of the plenary sessions from the opening night of the conference. It's entitled Conscience on the Front Lines, and it was delivered by Dr. Jeff Barrows, an OBGYN author, educator, and medical ethicist who is currently serving as Senior Vice President of Bioethics and Public Policy for the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, or CMDA. In this address, slightly edited for time, Dr. Barrows looks at the realities facing those who work on the front lines of medicine when it comes to issues of conscience. Here is Dr. Barrows.
Well, thank you, Matthew. I also want to thank the Center for inviting me to speak here this evening. I'm honored to be with you and especially honored to be here in person. There was a little bit of question of that for a little bit of time because of a health situation, but glad to be here and also very glad that the Center has chosen the topic of conscience as the theme for this particular conference. I think it is a critical and important theme. In fact, it's the main theme that I'm focused on in my advocacy work at CMDA. It touches on so many other different topics, and of course, it's under attack. And finally, I want to thank Dr. Lamparis for laying that foundation of theology of conscience. And what I'm going to be dealing with mainly, as she talked about toward the end, is the whole concept of coercion of conscience. And we are experiencing that more and more all the time. So this is, as Dr. Epinette mentioned, a talk on the front lines. And so what I want to do is talk and address several questions about how did we get to this place, where are our threats coming from, and also what is CMDA doing about that. And then in the midst of this, I'm going to be bringing up stories of conscience, stories of coercions of conscience. And you'll find that these stories are going to be very general because I have removed, for obvious reasons, any identifying information. Many of these stories are actually being represented in court cases right now where the recipients of this coercion are filing lawsuits. So they'll be somewhat general, yet specific enough for you to get an idea of exactly what's going on. So those will be interspersed throughout the talk, and I look forward to Q&A afterwards. As I get started, I think it's critical for us to really lay a foundation of language. And in fact, I think that those who oppose us in this many times do a better job of picking the right language and of framing the arguments than we do. I don't think we often think enough about what language we ought to use, what terminology, how to frame the particular argument or issue that we're trying to talk about. So when I started at CMDA a little less than 2.5 years ago, the issue was that we're talking about was called conscience rights. That's the way the organization knew about it. That's the way I thought about it initially for a long time. But the longer I've been in it, I've begun to wonder that, no, that may not be the best way to address this. Because what happens when we talk about conscience rights is that we're then put into a big kettle of other people talking about their own rights. You've got reproductive rights out there. You've got gay rights, lesbian rights, all kinds of things. And it's just then becomes a battle of whose rights are more important than someone else's. And so after thinking about this and talking to several of the legal organizations that we're involved with in our various lawsuits, I've decided that the best language is to use conscience freedoms. It's hard to argue with the concept of freedom. And I don't know that there are others that are talking and using specifically the terminology of freedom, but reproductive freedom I hear every now and then. But that's my preference, and I'm going to try and use that throughout this talk. And I would encourage all of you to think about this as well as you engage in discussions and perhaps even in writing, to think about using the concept of conscious freedoms rather than conscience rights. The other issue is one that I've also had to learn over time. In fact, it was Dr. Bob Orr, who, when I was giving a talk on human trafficking at an annual CMDA meeting, I had my slide up, and I think the slide was human trafficking for the healthcare provider. And he had gotten to the workshop early, and he gently came up to me and he said, "Jeff, you may want to think about changing that from provider to professional." He was very gentle and very kind, and at the time I thought, okay, I can do that, and I did, but I really didn't understand the importance of that until much later, and I will actually get into that a little bit more, because it really gets into the question of how we got to where we are today. So that's the language, and let me start with the first vignette. I'm a third-year medical student. In my second semester, we take a medical ethics course. On numerous occasions, I was repudiated by the professor for my unwillingness to profess as acceptable her position that all physicians must refer a patient wishing an abortion to an abortion provider, since I obviously was unwilling to perform one myself. The professor's point was that the woman desiring the abortion was my patient, and I was ethically bound to refer her in order to meet my ethical obligation of non-abandonment, once I had accepted her as a patient. My response to her was that I was ethically and morally beholden to defend the life of the unborn child, and that my vow of placing my patient's well-being before all else took precedent in preserving the child's life over terminating the pregnancy for the woman's convenience. Another similar story. In my residency, I was the chief of the obstetrical service and was thus responsible for the care and management of all of the obstetrical patients on the clinic service. We had a patient at the time whose baby was diagnosed with Down syndrome, and the mother had decided to abort. Since she was so far along, she was to have labor induced and was to be managed on the obstetrical floor. I spoke with my attending physician and told her that I could not, in good conscience, participate in this patient's care because of my Christian values. I explained that I had made arrangements with another resident who was willing to oversee this patient's care in my stead. The attending proceeded to reprimand me loudly in front of my team of residents, interns, and medical students. She accused me of abandoning my patient, of shirking my responsibilities, and being insensitive to my patient. Not once did she acknowledge that I had a legitimate right to take such a stand. It raises the question, how did we get here? How did we get to this point where we have to defend our conscience? And if you look at the Hippocratic tradition, which we are all wanting to do as bioethicists, we start there so frequently. We realize that for 2,300 years, this wasn't an issue. The original Hippocratic Oath talked about not performing abortions, not giving poison to assist in someone's death, not to engage in inappropriate sexual contact with the patient or the family, and to keep their information confidential. All very important concepts, but nowhere did the Hippocratic Oath talk about the freedom of the physician to do only what they need to do. It wasn't even, I don't believe, even in the mindset of those who wrote the Hippocratic Oath. And so for 2,300 plus years, this was the standard. And then something changed. And what was it that changed? Well, here's a familiar name to the Center on Bioethics and Human Dignity, Nigel Cameron. And he, as many of you know, if you've read this book, published this book in 1991. And I believe that in describing the new medicine, he really gets to the core of one of the major changes that has brought about all of the attacks upon the conscience freedoms of healthcare professionals. And I'll review for those who have read, and for those who have not, I'm going to just briefly talk about what is the new medicine. So for 2,300 plus years, the foundational purpose of medicine was to heal of disease. But with the 20th century and starting after World War II, there was a shift to relieving suffering. Now, I want to point out that as healers, we're always glad to see suffering lessened or alleviated. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem is when that becomes the primary foundational goal of medicine. And it's changed. And that is the goal today. We are no longer healers. We are relievers of suffering. And how does that impact? Well, when the focus of medicine was on healing disease, the focus then is on making the diagnosis, the correct diagnosis. And to make the correct diagnosis, we also had to understand the etiology of the disease process, the pathogenesis behind it. So that requires the expertise of the physician. And thus, we were seen as professionals. But this shift, and I won't say slight, this foundational shift to alleviating suffering has caused a shift not in the diagnosis so much, but really in the treatment. Getting the right treatment so that you're alleviating the suffering. It isn't so much about the etiology, but really more about the symptoms that the patient is experiencing. And I think the primary area of medicine that we see this is in mental health care. And I know that there are limitations within mental health that don't allow for the testing, but you see, especially in the APA, a primary emphasis on what are the symptoms, and that is the way a diagnosis is made, rather than through other testing. And so, rather than the expertise of the healthcare professional, now the emphasis is on the experience of the patient. And so the healthcare professional becomes a provider. The other major driver, there's several others in this whole issue that I'll get to here, but so this shift has caused a shift in the physician-patient relationship, where the main onus of, and not so much the authority, but responsibility was on the physician. But when you become a reliever of suffering, the responsibility shifts to the patient giving you the right symptoms, and is the treatment working, and are you in fact relieving their suffering? There were other changes that Dr. Cameron briefly addressed. There is a shift from viewing life as sacred. And instead today, we view life as something that should deserve respect. Now, what that respect looks like differs among other people, and what qualifies for respect differs, and I don't have time to get into that, but that's been another major foundational shift as part of the new medicine. And of course, with the increasing secularization of our society, we've had the rise of autonomy. My personal belief is that it's been a two-way street. I think that the rise of autonomy has driven this shift in the new medicine, but I also believe that this shift in the new medicine has given patients more feeling of power within the relationship so that they have exerted their autonomy to greater and greater extent, so that we're seeing more and more threats to conscience with each passing year. Another major cause that in this whole issue is the driver of abortion. Because if you stop and think about it, in order to justify abortion is not a disease. Pregnancy is not a disease. It is a normal occurrence within women. And so this shift was necessary in order for the pro-abortion forces to justify abortion, recognizing and framing it as part of the suffering of women with unwanted pregnancies. Therefore, this is important. This is foundational. Whereas prior, there was nothing to heal. There was no reason to really even engage in abortion because it's not healing a disease. So this has been building for decades, especially around the abortion issue. Many of you may be aware, especially if you are like me, an OBGYN, of this 2007 committee opinion. And I want to draw your attention to the language used in this opinion. The limits of conscientious refusal in reproductive medicine. Not the limits of conscientious freedom. Not the limits of conscientious rights, the limits of conscientious refusals, deliberately framing it in the negative. And this has been reaffirmed, by the way, in 2017, but just to give you a little idea, I took some quotes from this. Conscientious refusals should be limited if they constitute an imposition of religious or moral beliefs on patients, negatively affect a patient's health, are based on scientific misinformation, or create or reinforce racial or socioeconomic inequalities. Notice how broadly those terms can be defined. What constitutes negatively affecting a patient's health? Are we talking physical health? Are we talking mental health? What about scientific misinformation? Who defines scientific misinformation? Or what about racial or socioeconomic inequalities? These are so broad that they can be used to justify almost any limit on conscientious freedom. What about this quote? Conscientious refusals that conflict with patient well-being, how do you define that? Should be accommodated only if the primary duty to the patient can be fulfilled. Well, what is the primary duty to the patient? It is their well-being. It is alleviating their suffering. So there's really no way to get around that particular quote. And lastly, physicians and other healthcare providers have the duty to refer patients in a timely manner to other providers if they do not feel they can, in conscience, provide the standard reproductive services that patients request. Do you see the importance of this shift in new medicine? Again, there is no way to justify this if we in medicine are primarily seen and function as healers. It's only when we begin functioning as alleviating the suffering of the patient and allowing the patient to define that suffering that then we fall into this, what I would call, a conscience trap. I was an OBGYN resident where there were 48 residents in the program, 12 in each of the 4 years. Mostly first and second year residents did elective terminations. Myself and a fellow resident in my year refused to do the elective terminations due to our religious background. Both of us were brought up in the Catholic faith. The chief physician over the residents called me into an office and was across the desk from me and proceeded to tell me that other residents were doing more work because I wouldn't do abortions. I informed him that I was in other clinics doing work instead. He looked at me and said, "Why won't you do the terminations?" Notice the language, terminations rather than abortions. I informed him that I was raised Catholic, and his response was, "So what?" I looked at him and said that I consider terminations murder. His face turned crimson red, and he started screaming at me. I actually thought he might come across the desk. He was so incensed. I had never before or after seen such anger. I said to him that if he found another program that I would accept going to, this program was my first choice for the residency, I would transfer, but that I would under no circumstances do elective terminations. There was a lot of intimidation on the residents to do abortions. Well, as many of you know, most of you know, I assume, that it didn't take long for this whole concept to spread beyond the issue of abortion and OBGYN medicine to other medicines. And so I don't know if you're familiar with this famous editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine. If you have not read it, I encourage you to read it. It came out in 2017, written by Dr. Ronit Stahl and Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, who happens to be the brother of Rahm Emanuel, who was previously the chief of staff for President Obama and the mayor here in Chicago for many years. This, again, notice the title, Physicians Not Conscripts, Conscientious Objection in Healthcare. A few quotes. Healthcare providers have a primary interest to promote the well-being of patients. Nothing about healing, nothing about disease, it's promoting the well-being of patients. Healthcare professionals, when providing care, must subordinate their self-interest and personal beliefs to patients' well-being and professional decision-making. And finally, healthcare professionals are not conscripts, and in a freely chosen profession, conscientious objection cannot override patient care. In other words, we as healthcare professionals freely chose to enter into medicine. Therefore, we are obligated to abide by our patients' wishes. That is the central argument of this editorial and continues to be the argument for many on this particular side of the issue. I am a second-year medical student where I am studying to earn an MD and a PhD. My school recently began requiring medical students to ask for the personal pronouns of their patients in all standardized patient encounters. Several of my classmates and I wrote a confidential letter to the course faculty requesting that we not be required to do so, as we believe that it is not in the best interest of the patient to encourage a disintegrated view of the body and gender. Interesting argument. In response, the faculty sent an email to the entire student body explaining that this requirement would not be removed, which prompted several classmates to contact the administration and request that the conscientious objectors be identified and required to complete additional indoctrination in non-unified gender theory. I found this reaction very disappointing. And it caused me significant distress during an already difficult time in my training. I can imagine, only a second year medical student. The very idea that my classmates would advocate singling me out for retribution in response to an expression of my sincerely held ethical beliefs is proof enough that strong legislation is needed to protect the rights of physicians to practice in accordance with their moral code. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. In the walk-in clinic where I work, a biological female who was transitioning to the male phenotype came in complaining of chest pain. Upon further questioning, it was clear that the pain was due to their practice of breast binding. A therapeutic intervention would have been to stop breast binding, but I entered into that discussion with some concern about potential ramifications from administration if this individual were to complain about my approach being insensitive to the needs of the patient. Again, that's the primary here. Additionally, with transgender patients, the use of gender pronouns in the medical chart can be a sensitive issue. At this point, a safe workaround continues to be using a neutral pronoun such as they. Although now, with patients having open access to office visit notes, it's just a matter of time until a transgender individual calls administration, demands their pronouns be changed, and sets up a showdown with the documenting provider where right of conscience could be in play. So, what are the major sources of conscience threats on the front lines today? I can only deal with the major ones, not all of them due to time constraints, but I'm going to start with the federal government. How many of you are familiar with Rule 1557 in HHS? Just a few of you, okay. The nomenclature, the number is derived because Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act that was passed in 2010 contains the definition of discrimination. And the original wording was along the traditional lines that all of us would agree would qualify as discrimination: race, color, national origin, sex, age, or disability. And this was fine. This was fine until 2016. And at the end of the Obama administration, his HHS decided that they were going to weaponize the concept of discrimination. And here's what I mean. What they did is they added a few words to the definition of sex discrimination. They added the words gender identification and pregnancy. Gender identity and pregnancy. Now that changes the entire definition of sex discrimination. Now, I want to be clear that we at CMDA do not agree with anybody, any of our members or anyone else, especially those that call themselves Christians, to ever not agree to see a patient for routine medical care, regardless of their sexual orientation or their gender identity. We strongly support that every patient, regardless, should be seen for routine medical care. We draw the line at being forced into certain procedures. And we recognize that this change in definition would suddenly make our members amenable to accusations of sex discrimination if they failed to follow a patient's request at gender transition, or failed to refer for abortion or perform an abortion if they were pregnant, because they could then be seen as guilty of sex discrimination, because it now includes pregnancy. It includes gender identity. So because of that, CMDA filed a federal lawsuit in the District Court of Northern Texas later in 2016. I won't go into a lot of detail. We won that because the court rightly saw that there was not enough provision for religious liberty in this new definition. It was appealed to the Fifth Circuit. And by the time it was appealed to the Fifth Circuit, or by the time the decision was made, it was 2019. And in that appeal, we at CMDA and the other parties in the lawsuit had requested that the Fifth Circuit would grant us a permanent injunction for our members against this rule that would, in essence, permanently protect us. Well, because the decision that was made by the Fifth Circuit in 2019 with the Trump administration in power, they saw that the threat to conscience was not nearly as great as it had been. They decided they would not give us a permanent injunction. But they still ruled in our favor. And it put us in the very unusual and slightly awkward position of whether or not we should appeal the decision that we had won. And we talked with our attorneys at Beckett, and thankfully we agreed that we would appeal it because we didn't know what was going to happen in the future. And so we went back to the federal district court, appealed that decision, asking the district court to grant us a permanent injunction. It's one of the few positives of the Biden administration coming into power, I might add. But when they did, and they began their actions threatening conscience, the federal district court said, yes, you have very good reason at needing a permanent injunction. So they granted CMDA, our members and future members, a permanent injunction against Rule 1557, which still stands today. We're very happy about that. So basically, no member of CMDA, either now or in the future, can be attacked by HHS or any of its entities on the basis of Rule 1557. Of course, the Biden administration was not happy with that. They appealed the decision. It is now back in the Fifth Circuit. But the good news is the permanent injunction still stands. The bad news is the Biden administration has decided they're going to revise further the Rule 1557. And what we're hearing through the grapevine is that the revision is likely to be worse than even what the Obama administration had given us. We're expecting this to actually come out and be rolled out in the next few weeks, any day now. A professor at a university medical school was demoted and then failed to have his contract renewed even after many years of excellent reviews, simply because he spoke out publicly against medicalized gender transition in minors. Notice, this particular professor did not go against his university, did not even talk against their rules, did not go to the students and argue and oppose the administration, didn't do anything within the university. He simply spoke out publicly against gender transition and lost his job. A psychiatrist on the West Coast was fired from his group practice because of his support and rare use of specialized therapy to help people deal with unwanted same-sex attraction. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the terminology of conversion therapy. There really is no such thing, but that is what's frequently used in the press and in laws. And it's basically any therapy that is attempting to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. It is an absolute no-no in the eyes of progressives. And in fact, last week, the Biden administration released an executive order that will further that ban, not only in this country, but across the world. A female OBGYN resident in Kansas was forced to resign from her residency just months before completion because of her refusal to refer for abortions or contraception, insisting on building a practice based solely on natural methods of contraception. So, imagine this young woman has given almost 5 years of her life in being trained and certified as an OBGYN in the last several months because of her conscience views on this issue. She is kicked out of that residency. So I've talked at length about federal threats to conscience, but unfortunately, that's not the only level. We can move then to the state level, and as we look around the country, we're not surprised to see that the state that is leading the way is the state of California. They just recently, in the past 3 months, passed a law on assisted suicide that mandated that healthcare professionals must participate in the timing of how long a patient has to wait to get assisted suicide. They did this by dropping the length of time a patient waits from 14 days down to 48 hours. And they mandated that the first healthcare professional the patient sees, regardless of their views on assisted suicide, that healthcare professional must document in the medical record that that patient came to see them for the issue of assisted suicide, requesting assisted suicide. Therefore, that means that that healthcare professional is participating in their assisted suicide. So we have, with the help of ADF, filed a lawsuit against this law, citing coercion of conscience, and it is currently being litigated. It'll take some time before it's decided, but since it's in federal court. I'm an OBGYN physician. I've been working overseas for the last 8 years. At this point, I don't see how it is possible for me to practice good medicine according to my conscience in my home state of Virginia. If I do not do or refer for abortion, or do not manage or refer for transition hormones for adolescents, I can be sued for discrimination. This person is aware of what's happening at the federal level. I have worked all over the world with many races, ethnicities, and religious groups. I can provide quality and compassionate, excellent health care. I am willing to do this for little or no salary for many who do not have resources to get the care they need. But I will not be driven out of the profession in my home country if I cannot make decisions with my patients that are consistent with my beliefs. This is also consistent with a survey that CMDA did in 2019, where we surveyed our members and asked them basically how many of you would get out of medicine if your conscience freedoms were restricted in such a way that you could not practice medicine according to your conscience. 92% answered either they were very likely or likely to leave medicine if that were the case. Unfortunately, this is not also limited to the state. ADF in the last 3 to 4 months has informed us that across the country, many cities have now begun passing these very broad sex discrimination definitions, very similar to Rule 1557, that would cause a healthcare professional to be accused of sex discrimination if they did not allow a patient or help a patient through gender transition or even refer for an abortion at the patient's request. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Jeff Barrows of CMDA addressing conscience on the front lines from our recent conference, Integrity and Conscience, Bioethics and the Professions. All of the content from the conference, 8 plenary addresses, 4 sponsored workshops, more than 20 paper presentations, all of these are now available on demand through the conferencing app. Email events@cbhd.org today for information on how you can access this conference content. You've been listening to the Bioethics Podcast, a project of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, copyright 2022, all rights reserved. The Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity is a Christian bioethics research center at Trinity International University, exploring the nexus of biomedicine, biotechnology, and our common humanity. Our website, cbhd.org, has a wealth of materials on a wide range of bioethical issues. For more information about the center and to support the work of the center and projects like this podcast, please visit our website, cbhd.org. All post-production for the Bioethics Podcast is done by CBHD Communications and Marketing Manager, Curtis Wayne Pierce, Jr. My name is Matthew Epinette, and I'm the Executive Director of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. Thank you for listening to the Bioethics Podcast.